Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. And we do apologize, along with our sister stations, for the actions that the U.S. government and military are taking around the world, because this is not what the American people want. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Hello and welcome to Gather Round. I'm Ruth Santamarte Feo, and we have a full hour and a half tonight. In just a little while, I have a couple things I'm going to talk about, and then Joey Baird from the Wisconsin VegetableGardeners.com will be here. At the half-hour mark, we've got Sarit Jacobson, and at the next hour, top of the hour, Rick Schmidt is here with more about Bigfoot. So right now, there's a couple things in the news I just like to mention. I believe last week I may have talked about the flooding in Kashmir. So, you know, I mean, that was enough. Kashmiris never seem to catch any kind of a break. The country's been occupied by India for over 60 years with dreadful treatment, from rapes to disappearing people to murders. And now, then last month, beginning of September, I saw this horrible flood. It's the worst in a century there. And it, of course, will take a long time to recover. It's been said that the flood was Kashmir's Hurricane Katrina, which, you know, gives you a little bit of an idea of what it's about. Now, the Indian troops and the Pakistani troops are once again firing at each other over at the LOC, which is the line of control. And because of this, many Kashmiris are on the move again. They're fleeing their homes. 4 people were actually killed in their home, and 16 people have been murdered. I believe that's 9 on the Indian side and 7 on the Pakistani side. So just please keep Kashmir in your thoughts. If there's anything you can do, any petitions, any people you can talk to, please do. And a little bit of good news when it comes to the greenies, you know, we can hope that this will last. The Supreme Court of Chile has put on hold the development of the gold copper mine owned by the Canadian conglomerate Goldcorp. Now, they've had to stop construction there 2 different times because of the indigenous people taking the court. So this court has said that the community has a right to be consulted. And, you know, hopefully enough people will join in and throw that company out. The mine is estimated to be worth about $4 billion, though, and we know what money does and how it talks. But the indigenous people say that it will pollute the local river if allowed to be in operation. And, of course, that makes sense because we know that mining is a very, very dirty business. So that's something you may not have heard about. There's a lot of things going on there in the South American and Latin American countries as far as countries coming in and trying to heal their resources, you know, like every place. Today is the blood moon, full moon, and the eclipse. And I got to see the eclipse this morning. It wasn't total, but it was close. So it was really nice. I was up and out, and it was a little after 5 when it was at its most covered, where I am in Illinois anyway. But tonight, I just wanted to talk a little bit because, you know, I try to talk about simplicity and living more of a simple life. Well, Samhain, Halloween, is coming up, and a lot of people consider this their favorite time of the year, with Halloween, then you've got Thanksgiving, then you've got Christmas, and autumn, though, in Illinois, probably most of the places in the United States, is a beautiful time of year, with the leaves changing, it's starting to get crisp, and you know, you can smell fires burning in backyards and around, and the leaves. It's just a great time. But one of the things that people love to do is have the Halloween parties, you know, costume parties, masquerade parties. And of course, it's fun. It's fun, or maybe more for adults than for kids. But I wanted to just touch on the fact that, you know, the costumes, it's fun, I think, to raid your closet, raid your friend's closet, raid your husband's, your wife's, whoever's, your kid's closet, but make up your own or go to a thrift store. You know, I've judged a few of these, and I'll tell you that nobody who was wearing something from a shop that was already ready-made won the contest. I don't care like how clever it was, because, you know, it's about being clever and putting your own together, in my opinion. Also, it's much cheaper than that that kind of fabric stuff and whatever that you get in a costume shop, which shows no imagination, no creativity. All it shows is that you have the money to blow. So I would just like to say, please, 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 go ahead. Think. You know, if you're having a hard time, think about the things you wanted to do when you were a kid, you know, your occupations, or maybe what did you dress up as a kid? Think about that. And now there's so many more options, of course, but, you know, it can actually be fun to put something together, and you know that you're not going to run into your twin. If you're out doing the rounds of parties or bars or whatever, you know, if you've come up with the costume yourself, it is yours. And so if you're in a contest, you've got a better chance of winning, at least if I'm judging it. But a lot of people feel like I do. So go for things that are already around. Don't go out and spend money on new things that you're just going to have to throw out or whatever. It's not worth it. It should be about having fun. And, you know, everybody has a creative side, so show it. I think that's the best thing I can say. And if anybody wants to send me pictures of what they're going as, I'd love that. I want to mention on YouTube, there are tons of videos. If you want to get into the different kinds of makeup, or if you want to do the horrifying faces and have the globs of something, you know, stuck on your face or your arms or something, all of that's on YouTube. So, you know, there's no excuse for not. But now, I just want to bring in a guest who we had on Akasha Temple Live many times. And in fact, he's been on this show before too. So if I can just get this, come on, Block Talk, work with me. Okay. We've got Joey Baird. Hello, Joey.
Hello, Roseanne.
It's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said in the thing, a lot of people garden and a lot of people want to. And then there's the people who are really just sort of interested, like the people that used to sit back and watch the, what was it, This Old House. But they right. wouldn't know how to pick up a hammer. But they like to watch people doing things, and they like to sort of imagine. So you fall right in there. You and your wife have been gardening for a while. You both grew up in families that gardened, so you had a good start. But you have your own YouTube channel. You do videos. You speak around the Midwest, and you're right. out of Wisconsin, and you've picked up sponsors. You guys, you're really doing something right for sure. So you're the logical person to ask, what do we do now? This is October. to close down the garden, is it too late to plant anything for the, like, late season, the second or third season?
You could plant radishes. Radishes are a very quick-growing vegetable. You're looking at 18 to 32 days based on the variety that you choose. So you can get them in the ground, and they do handle a light frost. Obviously, if it freezes, that it'll kill them. And you can also prepare for spring next year and by planting garlic. There's still time to get garlic in the ground. If you can get it in the ground approximately 3 to 5 weeks before your ground freezes, you're in good shape on that, so you can have garlic in late May, early June to mid-June next summer.
Okay. Yeah, because I had heard some people were going to plant garlic. So is there any, like, if you go ahead and plant it now, is there anything you have to do to it during the winter?
No, absolutely not. You'll hear people say they mulch their garlic or they with a straw or leaves. If you plant it about a month, three weeks to 6 weeks before the ground freezes, the key is to get good root establishment on the clove that you planted of the garlic. And then as the spring breaks and the soil begins to thaw, then when that garlic is one of the toughest plants you can grow in your garden, once the spring begins to thaw, the roots have already been established because of getting that in the ground before winter. And then the energy from the clove can begin to put top growth on, and then the whole process of the plant growing properly begins. But getting good root establishment before it goes into dormancy in the fall is the key to having good garlic bulbs in the spring and early summer.
Okay, that makes sense. So you're saying maybe radishes or something else, but definitely garlic. And because you're even further north than me, so it will probably be colder sooner there. What about, after you harvest and everything, there's a bunch of stalks, this and that, all over your garden. Is it better to go ahead and clean all that up in the autumn, or should you wait till spring and plow it under, or what do you do with all of that?
Well, preferably, if you have the time in the fall, it's good to get the garden cleaned up so when spring comes, you're not doing maintenance on the garden. You're ready to just loosen the soil up and plant the seeds. We like to remove all the plants, all the dead foliage out of the garden in the fall, and especially now with tomatoes, because we fought the tomato hornworm. It's a horrible worm that comes and destroys your tomato plants, you eat your fruit that's ripe. So what the moth that the worm comes from actually lays its larva in the soil, and it stays in the soil over winter. So what we're going to do, and from the studies and the experiments that we've read online, by tilling up, or what we recommend is loosening the soil with a broad fork, garden fork, or shovel, not necessarily tilling with a tiller, but if that's what you have, that's what you have. That will reduce the chances of you experiencing the hornworm next spring and summer by upwards of 90%. You loosen the soil up in the fall to try to disturb that larva, and then you do it again in the spring and avoid planting tomatoes in the same locations as you did this year. And tomato hornworm will also eat your peppers as well, so you want to keep that in mind. But by loosening that soil in the fall and the spring, you're greatly reducing the chance that you're going to get it because you're destroying the larva that's in the soil. So that's something that we really encourage people to do. If you have the time, get that garden prepped, loosen the beds up, so all you have to do is come in, very minimal amount of work you have to do in the spring, and you're ready to plant.
Oh, okay. So I mean, that makes sense psychologically, so that you aren't bogged down in the spring before you even get around to planting. I mean, you haven't worked yourself silly. But now you said that you should plant the tomatoes in a different location. What about other vegetables? I mean, isn't that pretty much a good practice just to plant things differently?
Right, yeah. Obviously, if you have a large amount of space, such as a traditional ground garden like we do, it's easy to maneuver the plants around. Different plants require a different amount of sunlight. You want to keep that in mind. But if you're on a very small scale, one, if you're in containers, you want to get rid of that soil if you've experienced the hornworm because the larva is in the soil. If you're in a small 4x4 raised bed, going to be a little harder to maneuver the plants around, but you basically want to take it and move it to the opposite side of the bed that it was on this year. And this brings up another point. Next spring, it may not be as easy to remember what you had planted where this year. So just make a little note for right now, because you can remember that you had lettuce in this corner or peppers in that corner or where you had plants at, so you don't make the mistake of planting that particular plant in the same location again next year, because plants take certain nutrients out of the soil and certain plants put nutrients back in the soil. So it's just the best practice to rotate the crops around to it's in a different location this year for next year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's one of those lessons that we can learn from farmers way back before the big corporations bought all the smaller farms. They did rotate their crops. So like you say, some
right.
things take out nutrients or whatever, and others put it in. So, and your idea, I mean, definitely just make a map of your garden. It doesn't have to be gorgeous. I mean, it's just this and this and this is where, yeah, it was. Because you will forget.
Or even just take a few pictures with your old-style camera
exactly.
or your digital camera or your phone.
Right, right. And then take the pictures. But have some kind of a record because, you know, I know people say, oh, I won't forget because this was here and this was there. And, you know, we have so many things on our minds nowadays. And, yes, you're going to forget. You're going to make a mistake. So, sure, draw the map out.
We do videos, and we have to go back and look at the videos to sometimes remember what we had planned where. So you're not going to remember. Don't make yourself think you are. You're just lying to
yeah.
yourself. Just take a picture, and it's going to be a lot easier next spring.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that just makes sense. It costs nothing. It takes no time. Just do it. What do you... Like a couple years ago, did you have any clue that you would be doing so much publicly in the gardening realm as you are now?
Absolutely not. With each project we take on, which with each new video series we do, it opens up another opportunity to share the knowledge. In addition to the videos, we do a digital quarterly magazine, which is free for downloadable on your iPad or computer on our website, as well as
That's
we
right.
now write. As well as we write for, I believe, 10 different newspapers. You actually open the newspaper up in 5 or 6 different states now on a weekly and biweekly and monthly basis to help share the knowledge of gardening. Because the problem with gardeners, and you can talk to Peon Smith, Joe Lample, or your neighbor down the street, the problem with gardeners is we make things too complicated. We overthink too many things. We need to keep
yeah.
it very simple. And the simpler it is, most times, the better end result you're going to get.
Right, and the more people you can get interested in it, if you're just showing that it's not that complicated, yeah, and it's not, I mean, you spend a lot of time because you have gardens in several locations.
Yes, yeah, we
but,
have three different gardens, and it, you know, that takes a lot of time, but it also allows us to have an experience and learn the different climates in each area and pass that information on that, you know, the traditional backyard gardener only has a small plot, but knowing the information that we are able to provide that in this location, this plant grows really good and we tried it in the next location and it didn't, and here's the reason why it didn't work better in the second location as it did the first location. So it is a very wonderful thing to have the experience of multiple locations to garden, but it is a handful to try to keep everything organized when the time of harvesting and planting comes.
Yeah, I could imagine that. I was going to ask, how much time a week have you ever just estimated or actually tried to keep track, you and Holly, for a period of time? Like how many hours?
With the harvesting or the planting and the canning, on an average week, you're looking at maybe 5 to 8 hours of actual gardening work. Now, with the social media and the website and all that, that's probably another 8 to 15 hours if you add all that up. But just physical in the garden, you know, you can spend as much time as you want. But for us, I'm looking at maybe 8 to 10 hours a week. But for the average gardener, you can really just spend a few minutes a night or a couple hours on a weekend and make a very, very successful garden and get a very good harvest out of that garden.
Right. And, yeah, because most people aren't going to be spending as much time as you will in the first place because you've got the different locations, and then you have to count travel time and everything too. But
in addition to that, you know, what would take us normally 20 minutes to do, it probably takes us 40 or 45 because we're setting up shots for our videos and we're making sure everything looks right. So there's an additional production time that's added into that that most people don't have to experience.
Exactly. That. So, I mean, it's but when you're saying like 8 to 10 and maybe 12 to 15, whatever, I mean, you're wrapping up some hours. And so it has to be something that you love to do and are really learning from, because that, I mean, you both have day jobs still,
right,
I think.
Right. Both. Yeah, and, we're professional gardeners with full-time jobs, so that's kind of what we entitle ourselves. But yeah, we both have full-time jobs, so the time is limited to what we can do in the garden, but it is very enjoyable, and we do love it very much. Otherwise, this is not something we would spend our time doing.
Exactly. It's but I mean, some people now, gardening is a wonderful hobby for people because it does all these things. You get your exercise, you get the connection with nature, you have something to show for it if you have a crop. I mean, so it's good. People, what term am I looking for? Maybe it's gentleman gardeners or something. There's that kind of people who like, they really don't need the harvest. I mean, they may end up giving it away or something, but I mean, they might keep a couple tomatoes for themselves, but they're going to give things away, but they just like the idea, but it gets them outside. So I'm like, for anything that does that. Have you been doing much, or do you have it in the future, working with kids, like community gardens or just private gardens with kids? Because I think that if you get them when they're little, you've got a better chance of turning them on to it. Because everybody likes to eat what they grow, I would think.
Right. Now, we haven't necessarily, we have talked about ideals of that. We also have a 3-year-old niece and almost a 1-year-old nephew. And our niece, she's very active in the garden. Holly watches her several days a week as a babysitter, and she's always asking if I'm at work or if I'm watering the garden. And she always she says I got to go out and water the garden because Joy wants me to. She'll go out and pick tomatoes, and she's very intrigued and understands how the garden works, and really looks up to the garden they have in their backyard and in her backyard. They have a number of tomatoes and cucumbers and squash, but she's always wanting to go out and harvest something or water something, and always excited whenever we can plant or harvest any particular crop, because she wants to get out in the garden. And like you said, she knows where the food comes from, and she doesn't think it came from aisle 9 at the local supermarket. She understands you put the seed in the ground, and you grow it, and then you can eat it. And she's very excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great that you've, you know, got her so she's understanding, and the excitement, it's, I mean, I remember my parents always gardened, and I was always out there, you know, maybe coming along watering something with or whatever. But I can remember planting and hoeing. Oh, my goodness, hoeing. Because they gardened differently. I mean, it was rows, and so there were, I mean, sometimes they had straw, sometimes not. So there were not a lot of weeds, but I remember the weeds. I had my own hoe. And So, but it's just on many levels, it teaches kids, and they get that connection then. Like you said, she knows that things come up out of the dirt, they grow up, and it's not from the supermarket aisle wrapped in on top of styrofoam with plastic wrapped around it or something, which is an abomination anyway. But,
right.
Yeah, I just thought that there might be, I don't know, there might be programs that, like summertime programs for kids in cities where you could get in on some of that, because I would think that they're usually wanting somebody to help out with different ideas or something. Have you done much work with community gardens in your talks around?
We worked with a community garden a few years ago. We helped put in some raised beds, and that was really the beginning stages of before we became overwhelmed with all of the productions and videos and media that we do here. And with our videos, you know, our website is the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, but it's for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide. So just because we're in Wisconsin, that doesn't mean if you're in Florida or Venezuela or Russia that you can't learn something from our information. Our information
Definitely.
Is very universal, and it can benefit you. You may have to tweak some of the times you plant, but the information is worldwide and universal for all gardeners, no matter where you live. And that's something that, you know, people want information that's easy to understand and that's for them. And that's what we offer.
Right. No, I mean, I think you guys are just doing a great job because you, like, nothing is, nothing's too insignificant or too overwhelming for you to tackle it. I like
right.
that. I mean, you'll talk about anything, and you do. And then you also have videos on canning and making some different things. I've seen Holly cook. So you're really pretty much all around.
Yeah. Backyard gardening, preserving, and a little bit of homesteading, I guess, would be the term that would be used. And Holly has taken many classes, and she's a state fair award-winning canner
right.
2 years in a row now.
Yeah.
And now canning is a little different than gardening. Gardening is very simple. Canning is a science, and there is specific directions you must follow in order to can properly. Otherwise, you can get diseases, and you can die from those diseases. So that's
exactly.
something you need to take very seriously.
I mean, yeah, you want to use, like, the latest in the like the, what is it, USDA or something. I mean, because
right.
it's different than it was, you know, years and years ago. And I cringe when I hear people say, oh, you know, I've got this canning book my mother used, and that's what I use. And I just go, ah!
Yeah,
because even, you know, like tomatoes, they're different now than they were, unless you're really doing the heirloom and all. And, I mean, they've discovered different ways to can. So you keep up to date on that for sure.
Yeah, be sure you have a recipe that's within the last 15 years published. Obviously, your great-grandmother's recipe is a nice heirloom to have, and that's what it is, an heirloom. Put it in a frame or put it somewhere where it's safe, but don't use it. Don't use it to cook with.
Right. Put it on the wall in the kitchen or the dining room or something. I mean, that's cool. It's nice to have something from your grandma, but, yeah, don't put your health in the hand of that particular recipe. It's like, not so good. But since you both grew up gardening, did it have anything to do with gardening or the outdoors?
No, when we met, Holly was, I still lived on the farm, and Holly lived in an apartment, and, you know, the conversation talked about gardening, but it never came to fruition until we actually moved back up to Wisconsin, where Holly is originally from, and Holly was talking to her mom, and her mom said, well, you guys can use my backyard, use everything you want, because I'm tired of cutting the grass. So we turned what her backyard was into 1,700 square feet of growable space now, with very, very minimal amount of mowing that has to be done on a biweekly schedule.
Okay, well, I'm sure she is thrilled that she suggested that because, right, the mowing is minimal and she's getting all these veggies for you guys, so.
Right.
I mean,
she's very pleased with the backyard when she can look out and see the garden a whole lot
right.
better than a yard.
Yeah, well, what are they calling it? Oh, food not lawns or something?
Yeah, grow food not lawn, yep.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful, and I realize that there's some places that supposedly it's illegal to do that because they want, I don't know, they want two bushes in the front yard and only those two bushes. But have you run into anything yourself in the different places you garden as far as that kind of thing?
No, we haven't. Now, where the large garden is, it's not illegal to grow in the front yard, but it's also not encouraged. We do have a small little area where a stump used to be several years ago, where we're trying to build up a small strawberry patch in the front yard that's taking a little longer than what we had anticipated. But no, it's not. We have not personally ran into anything such as that. But if you live in a certain cities, as well as homeowner associations are just wonderful for telling you that you can't do what you want to do in a country that's free.
Exactly.
We have a number of friends that have had issues in regards to that, and you can find a lot of stories online on reputable media outlets that have had stories where people wanted to grow in the front yard because that was the only viable place to grow, and they were told not to, and because of the overwhelming support of gardeners from around the country and the world, they have changed laws in their city to allow growing in the front yard. And Ruthanne, you're old enough to remember, after World War II, that was encouraged to grow wherever you could. That was called the Victory Garden.
Do they still have that on TV? Because I used to watch that on TV, the Victory Garden.
They have it, but it's nothing like it used to be.
Yeah, okay. When I was a little kid, I watched that, and it seemed like, such a good thing. And sure, because the government encouraged it then. So they should encourage it now instead of trying to make it hard on people.
Right.
Julie, I want to have you guys have you back, but for now I've got to let you go.
Okay.
The WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, and that's also what your YouTube is called, isn't it, the channel?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, both are the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. Yep.
Yeah. So that's not hard to remember, just sort of long, but it's good. So thank you so much, my friend. It's good to have you back.
Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful rest of the show.
Well, and please say hi to Holly.
I will do so.
Okay. Bye-bye, Joy.
Bye-bye.
Well, now we have Sarit Jacobson, Views the World. Hello, Sarit.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. You stunned me with the right before the show started. You sent me this horrid link, and
I did.
And it was like, this is. Do you want to tell our listeners, tell them what this was about? It's just beyond comprehension almost.
It is. We in Israel, most people who are awake in Israeli left know that we have a problem of Jewish terrorism in the settlements on a regular basis, which means that my friend, Guy Batavia, bless him, has to walk Palestinian children to school. Otherwise, they will attack the children. I know it sounds unbelievable. Actually, the article I send you, I had to read twice before I sent to you because I couldn't believe what I was reading. And then I read it third time because I thought I was imagined. I just couldn't believe it, you know. Who would attack a one-year-old child and kill it? And this is what happened here.
This young man, but
I was just the baby. I had to read it three times, and even now when I'm saying it to you, it doesn't sound like real. How do you say it? It sounds unreal.
I don't think that was real, because when I read the thing, it they said the kid, and that's a baby goat.
Oh, okay.
They attacked the young man, and they kicked this newborn baby goat, and it died.
Yeah.
So that's the kid. I know, when I first read that, until I read the end of it, I was thinking, what the hell? Like, they're evil.
Abusing a Palestinian child. Oh, okay, it was a child, it's so upsetting. I can't think when I see these things. I can't imagine how Palestinians must feel seeing this every day. People sound pretty cool and calm, and this made me boil.
I know, because this young man had been attacked twice. Now, this was back in 2007.
And undressed.
Yeah.
And they've been free ever since.
Right. So, I mean, it was before the one that they were charged with. Now, one of these guys has never been named or charged. But they attacked this young man, and then it was like 4 or 5 months later, they attacked him again, and they killed the baby goat. The guy kicked it, and they beat him, took his clothes off, and dumped him somewhere. And it took him until now, and they gave him 18 months. And then that was appealed, and now they gave him 30 months. 30 months for that. And the article
was I was blown away by what the settlers said in the video in Hebrew. Oh, they were talking English, too. They were saying that they always believed they thought the punishment was wrong and that it's all a lie. And
right. Yeah. It's like the court always believes the error. It's like, my God, you know, they had evidence. The judge was really appalled that this happened. But this man's friends were throwing him a goodbye party.
Yeah,
the event.
It's very popular.
The
culture of hate.
He was a hero. So he's going off to jail because he did all this horrible stuff to this young kid. So we're going to throw him a big party with all this music and food and drink and, you know, have a real big send-off because he's a hero. Encouragement. He should be so ashamed of himself. And they should.
There's no shame in the settlers are picked up the Talmud and I've taken some things very literally, and I don't even think it's a Jewish book. There's a famous rabbis in Israel who are talking against Islam.
And
telling them Palestinians are really Jordanians, anti-Semites. We don't understand the anti-Semitism. The Arabs are Semites. There's a big, big confusion going on purpose to confuse the people. In the meanwhile, Israel is getting more and more privatized, and they're oppressing the poor. Took a little bit of public housing away. They've been evacuating Jewish families out of homes like Palestinians now to build nice tall buildings for the rich. I was watching in the Israeli groups how they're evacuating Israeli people, yeah.
Well, see, it's going to take something like that to start waking them up, maybe.
This morning, someone from Israel who I have not unfriended, even though I've seen a few posts by him that I didn't like because he's a little bit of a Zionist, but he also likes me. I don't know why. He's a leader of some social justice, economic justice. I keep telling him a one-state solution is the answer. He says, oh, that would be a dream come true. I'm like, then dream it. Anyway,
yep,
he's starting a boycott. The right-wingers and the Zionists even are starting a boycott. They're pissed off at their privatization.
My God.
The high prices, the stupid wars. Even they are starting to realize, many of them are now realizing the war in Gaza was not good by looking at polls.
If that's wonderful, though, but what's he boycotting? What are they boycotting?
Israeli products.
Wow.
They're just going to buy from other countries because they say it's too expensive.
Wow.
And okay. They're pissed off. They don't like Bibi. Bibi's very hated there. I don't know how he gets to be. Maybe people like him, but I don't know those people. I only know people who hate him. Like, I have 600 Israeli friends who hate him.
Well, I don't know if people like him as much as, when you get to a certain leadership role and there's some money behind you, you pretty much get by with a lot of things. So I think that
he had a. There was a million march against him and nothing. I feel like he steals all their elections too.
Wow, a million? Wow.
Yeah. They're still protesting all the time. There's little protests all around for all kinds of causes, all against capitalism, privatization. If they knew, I believe that if they knew, like I know what's happening to Palestinians, they would be very angry. The problem is that they don't know, and the truth is being hidden from them, and they're being so manipulated by their media. It's just unbelievable. I try to watch their media to see what, and their media is just worse than Fox News.
Yeah, I think it's very frustrating for you to watch that. But see, that's what, like you and I have talked before, because I believe this too, that if they really knew, because we know there's very kind-hearted. I mean, look at the vegan movement in Israel.
It's huge. It's the biggest I've ever seen, and they're crying for every
animal rights.
Every animal.
They're so into that. So I know that these people have good hearts, and if they just knew the truth, they would. Things would be different.
Those who know the truth are very, very upset by the truth. And I know many people who are going to checkpoints, who are going to protest in Bilin and Kfar Kadum, Nalin, all those places, little villages that their lands are being confiscated. And I know Israelis are going to jail for them because they've been to those protests. So if they don't get shot at, after getting tear gas, when they get back home, they get a summons to go to court, and then they have to pay huge fines or go to jail.
Yeah, and like you've said, that the jails that the now this man that was going off being touted as a hero because he did all this stuff to this young Palestinian boy. Now he'll go to a pretty nice jail, but
I'm sure.
Yeah, but we know that the Israelis who are the activists and the lefties and all, when they're jailed, or the refuseniks or whoever, when they're jailed, it's more like where they put the Palestinians. It's they don't put them
exactly
in the nice places. Yeah. So
exactly. They a friend of mine wrote a status on Facebook that he wanted to kill the corporate leaders. So they came and took him to jail. In order to punish him, they put him in jail with a Palestinian in the same cell. Little did they know, the two had a party in the cell together. So he said he had a great time in jail with that guy, and he got to know a little bit more about the Palestinian struggle, and he said, well, we need a one-state solution. We need to unite with them.
That's right.
And I'm his biggest cheerleader. I was going, yeah, yeah.
Yes,
and
yes,
many
yes.
other Israelis are going, yeah, yeah, more than ever. So maybe the apartheid can end. Who knows?
Yeah.
It ended in South Africa.
That's right. I mean, it was very painful, and it finally happened. So, you know, while it seems so horrible, like, you know, he was thrown in jail, yada, yada, but because he was thrown in with the Palestinians and he learned more, like it turned out to be sort of a good thing, you know, You have to.
And he told us that there were rats in the cell. It was not clean. There was no sheets. It was not humane.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the way they treat, like other Israelis.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're doing the same thing. People in this country and around the world, they think, well, you know, the Zionists, they're just picking on those worthless, stupid Muslims and blah, blah. It doesn't matter. But the Christians are being discriminated against also.
Absolutely. And the saddest thing to me is the people who engage in nonviolent struggle are the people who get the most trouble from the authorities.
Right,
right. Nonviolent.
Well, if you're nonviolent, you're apt to have violence used against you.
The beautiful idealists. The anarchists have been called in the Israeli media dangerous animals with knives in their pockets.
Oh.
And anarchists are really people that don't trust leaders, so they like to organize collectively. And that is not a reason to demonize any human being for not trusting a leader when it's proven that leadership corrupts.
Exactly.
Psychologically.
Exactly. I mean, I would be more skeptical of somebody who just totally trusted the leadership of any of these countries without, you know, clearly thinking about things, because you know that they're easily led, obviously. I mean, and they don't think for themselves. They don't keep an
Absolutely.
Open mind.
Absolutely. On the other hand, the beautiful Uri Ferreira is serving a total of 137 days in jail for refusing to serve in IDF.
Well, a person with a conscience. In the short
he's
term,
he's a religious Jew.
Yeah, they're definitely not rewarded in the short term for doing the right thing.
Today there was Israeli police went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the second most holy place in Islam, and shot some kind of weapons in there and tear gas.
In the mosque?
Yes.
They were in did
in
it.
The mosque, yeah. It looked horrific to me. There was absolutely no reason to behave this way in a mosque. And their only reason they did it is not because they had some kind of criminal hiding in there that they needed to get. As far as I know, the reason they did it is just so settlers could come in and pray in there. Because 5 minutes after you see the Palestinians running out from the tear gas and the bullets, you see settlers coming in there. The settlers believe that place is holy to them, too.
And
it probably is to both.
Well, and there's nothing wrong. I mean,
share.
Before, way back, everybody went there. There was no problem.
Yeah.
I mean, and the Palestinians, they weren't going to try to chase the settlers out. They could have gone in and prayed. The Zionists, they went in and shot up because they could, because nothing would happen to them. They can do it. So they did it.
Well, in IDF, we call it showing presence, and it's a way to show who's boss and to put them in their place that they are occupied.
Yeah. What
These
do
are
you
words
call
of
it?
IDF soldiers. Showing presence.
Presence. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone in IDF who served knows those things. It's pretty bad language to use, psychopathic language, in fact, to use for interfering people with their prayers. And they're most vulnerable.
Well, there's something so wrong about going into someone's place of worship and shooting it up.
Can you imagine if it happened in a synagogue, how the mainstream media would pick up?
Oh, my goodness.
And it happens in Palestine all the time. Their mosques are being totally destroyed, violated. There's testimonies from the Gaza war, how they undressed the imam of the mosque to humiliate him, which the Israelis don't believe is true, even though I believe of a victim 99% of the time, even more. It's hard not to believe the victim when you hear the oppressors leaving comments at my posts. One of the most disturbing things I get is when I try to educate the Israelis every day on these huge groups so everyone can be in those groups.
Right.
And I educate them about Palestine, and the comments I get are like, we should have just killed everyone in Gaza, flattened them out. Oh, good, I'm glad we killed. Good, they're glad to see all the violence I share sometimes, so I get to the point where I'm afraid to share violence towards Palestinians because they're so happy to see it.
Yeah,
isn't that crazy?
It is crazy. It is. And, you know, you wonder, I mean, I'm glad that you are, because you are educating people to listen to you. And those
most of them don't. Oh no, they don't really listen to me. This beautiful lady, Professor Nurit Peled Elchanan, who used to be the Minister of Education, she was fired, said that people have a mind infection. They just, it's too many wrong ideas put to them in a young age.
Okay.
They say I'm brainwashed by Palestinians, and the Palestinians are lying to me about their oppression.
Right.
And it's really insane.
Hard. But it's very hard when you have been indoctrinated from the time you could walk and talk and speak, talk and speak is the same thing. But I mean, by the time you from the very beginning when you've been indoctrinated,
food in Korea.
I mean, and your TV says this. I mean, and if you're not meeting Palestinians, how are you going to know? But now we have social networks, so this is what social media, the greatest gift that I think that it has, is that people can.
I know.
Learn.
I love suggesting my Israeli friends, my Palestinian friends, and making them friends. It's great. Yeah, that's little things you can do with the media.
Yeah.
If you have Israeli friends and Palestinian friends, introduce them to each other. One of my friends from Jerusalem is going to marry a Palestinian boy, and she's Israeli. They've been having some trouble. They traveled to Ireland together, and she said because she was on the airplane, when she got on the airplane, they searched her for hours, strip-searched her, and even humiliated her because she was with a Palestinian boy.
Of course. Yeah.
So
I hear
all the little stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to...
She was very brave. She took it better than I would.
Well, and
my artist, and her name is also Sarit.
Oh,
honey.
But I bet that besides being, well, I think it would hurt. It would hurt you to know that. Just like what the U.S. is doing around the world, it hurts me. It hurts my heart.
It hurts.
Because,
yes.
You know, and so I know that. And so if the U.S. government did something like that to me, I mean, humiliated me, strip searched me, and all that, I would be so hurt, but I would be so angry too. So I think she might be.
Yeah, it creates anger. Yeah.
That's just so, because you feel like, I don't know. It just shouldn't happen. So there's absolutely no excuse.
Yeah, my Israeli friends are very hurt. I can tell that by the things they say that they're very upset by what is happening to them. And that's why they try to show solidarity and go to all the protests, and they would even go to Gaza for solidarity if there was no siege.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, it actually, in a ass-backward, convoluted way, by the Israeli government treating their own Israeli people the way they do, it's going to backfire on them. It is backfiring. So
it is backfiring.
Yeah.
The only people that support Bibi are the banks, the corporations, and I don't think he has a majority of votes like he pretends to have.
Well, we really won't know until there is some kind of an election or something. And we know that those are fixed so much anyway that, who does really know then? It's, because many elections are fixed. So I don't know if there anybody else that anyone has talked about and said, hey, when he's prime minister, is there anybody standing in line to take the job over?
There's many revolutionaries in Israel that are getting quite famous, but I don't think there's anyone who can take over now, sadly.
Yeah.
No. They need the publicity. There's somebody I like in Israel. She's a Palestinian woman from Jaffa City who has the Workers' Party. her name is Asama Jabaria. I like her a lot. But she doesn't even have one seat because they raised the bar, so she couldn't get in.
Oh.
They're afraid of her. She's too. She has a lot of charisma.
Ah.
She's a professor of philosophy and really amazing woman. I admire her. When she speaks, everybody has to listen.
Yeah,
so I'm hoping she would be the leader one day.
Yeah, but sure, they're going to try to keep her out. I mean, of course, a strong woman who has charisma, yeah, that there's no place in Bibi's world for that, unfortunately.
I don't think he's much of a feminist. They don't have equal pay for women over there,
okay.
And a lot of women, not only they suffer economic terrorism, I call it, because it's really bad. If a single mother is not capable financially of raising her kid, her kid gets taken away. And suddenly, you know, I look a lot on the Israeli stuff, and suddenly I find a group called Parents Who Lost Their Children. So I go and look, and it's a group full of people who lost their children because they couldn't afford a bill or two.
Oh my God.
Many of them are talking about the fact that they haven't seen their children in a year, haven't heard from them, don't know where they are. It's total corruption. I was shocked.
Well, now when they take those kids, do they take them and give them to wealthy Israeli families? Is that the idea? Or what do they do with them?
I think
them?
They put them in special homes that are privatized.
Okay, so basically they're just trying to punish the parents. And if they put them in privatized homes, then there's money in profit. Profit.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Right, because then they'll have like
lots
state.
Of money.
Oh, okay, that is, oh, I feel for those people. Oh, my God.
Me too.
I mean,
so it's hard for the Israelis to fight for the Palestinians because a million of them, I hear from the poverty report, are so poor they can't afford to eat.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they
some days in the month they don't even have food.
Well, who was it? Maslow or some who had that hierarchy of needs? I mean, and yeah, you really don't have the luxury of fighting for causes when your main thing is to fight for something to eat this week. So that works toward the government's agenda. You have this many people down and out, and they have no time.
But they'll give you free money to move to the settlements.
God.
And there's actually a demand. They give like $100 and something a day for people to move to new occupied houses. They just took a whole bunch of houses in Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And those houses that they took, they're going to hire people to sit there until settlers move in. And those people will be paid by the day and they will be armed.
Okay. Well, there you go.
And
yeah. Anybody listening that wants to make some fast money not doing anything, if you don't have any morals. If you don't have any morals,
if you're a right-winger or have no morals, you can get rich.
Yeah, or at least do okay. You're not going to starve. Okay, well, that pretty
much... Yeah, that's quite a lot of...
Bucks.
Yeah, that would... And, you know, they even though people are hungry there, I see every day the reports of how much food they burn to keep the prices of food up.
Oh, well, they
should really send it to Gaza.
And they do that around the world. I mean, this whole thing, these corporate people who, they don't care about the fact that food is needed, they only want to, like you said, burn it to keep the price. That is a crime or a sin or whatever you want to say is despicable. Because
absolutely.
Never,
even kids in America are hungry right now.
Right. And we waste 40%
of
our food.
One of the richest countries in the world.
Yeah. It's crazy. But Sarit, our time is up. We'll be back next Wednesday, same time. And
great.
We hope there'll be some good news. I know.
Might be some more good news. people with so much talk about when it comes to Palestine. My goodness. So much.
Yeah, there's always, because there's always bad news there. So maybe we'll have some good. Yeah.
Great.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye bye. Tonight, we're going to have Bigfoot with Rick Schmidt, and this has been pre-recorded, but Rick will be back with us live very soon. So, here we go. Well, hello, Rick. It's good to have you back.
How you doing, Ruth Ann? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, okay, well, I've been looking forward to hearing about Big Muddy, because you left us with that last time, just the idea. And I was talking about the river, the Mississippi, being called the Big Muddy. And then I guess there's another Big Muddy and a Little Muddy and all kinds of muddy.
There's Big Muddy and Little Muddy in southern Illinois. Runs through between Murfreesboro and Carbondale.
Ah, okay.
And runs through the heart of the Shawnee National Forest. That's a key factor.
That's okay. That makes sense, because besides being beautiful, I've been like near there a long time ago. It would be quite wild, parts of it, which would
it's very remote.
Yeah. So, tell me about Big Muddy. The not the river, the other Big Muddy.
Okay. The story goes, it happened in June 1973. I believe it was June 25th. I don't have the dates in front of me, but it was late June in 1973. And the first report was from there's a park in Murfreesboro called Riverside Park, and it's Riverside Park in Murfreesboro.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used as a lover's lane.
Ah.
Okay. And there was a young couple that were not married, but they, as far as I know, they weren't married. They were not doing an adulterous affair, but they were doing things that people do at lover's lanes.
Well, that's what lover's lanes are for. That's why they're called
that.
Yeah,
that's what lover lanes are for. And they were there because they did not want her father to find out that she was seeing this young man.
Of course. I've been there. Well, it wasn't that part, but okay.
Right. So they reported hearing a ungodly scream coming from the woods on the edge of the river.
Ah.
And they noticed a horrible stench. And he turned the headlights on of his car and saw a creature standing there, covered in mud, had white fur, and was covered in mud, just standing there observing them. And they got scared and beat feet and took off. And they were so scared that they made a police report, even though they did not want her dad to find out that she was down at the river with this boy.
Right. They had to be scared.
So you follow
then.
Me?
Yeah. And I mean, they had very
to this
scared.
Day, you know, you can still, I've looked up, this is the only case, one of only two cases in Murfreesboro's police history that are still open and have not been resolved.
Mike, and you said that was
1973.
Wow.
June.
No, I mean, I'm just imagining really the terror, because, like you said, I mean, that they were there because of her parents, her father, and then to go to
right.
the police and make a
yes.
report. I mean, you know,
because
you can ask.
What they saw was real.
Yeah.
They saw, Yeah, they knew it was real. They saw it. They thought, well, maybe the police need to know about this.
Yeah, so to go that public and then take the chance that the police are going to call on you at your home and everything, and your father is going to find out.
Right, and this information is all a matter of police record. Later on, there were two cops sent to the location later on that night. They observed. They heard a screech. They found footprints around the in the area, coming in and out of the water, and they observed smells. They did. I'm unclear about if they witnessed the creature that later that night, but they heard the scream from the forest.
They heard the screams and they smelled it.
And they smelled it. The two cops did.
Wow. But that's that was it. I mean, because they didn't go back or check anything more or what? The police.
That was pretty much it for the night. It was still an open case at that point. And then about a week later, there was another report of the creature messing around a farmhouse nearby the river, observed by two local lads who saw the creature. And they took off. They reported it to the cops. And there was even another report of the creature, and this is where it gets curious. It was back at the same Riverside Park, had a carnival, had a local, it was like a traveling carnival coming through.
Yeah.
And you know those rides where they have the Shetland ponies that give the kids pony rides in an endless circle?
Yeah.
You ever seen those?
Yeah.
Okay, they had one of those rides set up, and one of the carny workers noticed the creature standing over by the where they had the ponies tied up, looking at the ponies.
Kind of
had his head cocked, like, you know, what did you do to get tied up, you know?
Yeah, really. But he had that kind of a look, not the, ooh, I wonder what you taste like look.
No, it was more
curious.
You know, this creature was reported to be kind of aggressive, like, you know, wanted to act like he wanted to get at the people that seen him. But and kind of like the Momo creature, the one that eats the dogs, you know.
Wow.
Kind of like that, and that's more characteristics of Eastern type Bigfoot reporting. Is there a little more aggressive than the passive West Coast ones where all the hippies are?
Oh, okay. That's strange. Now, these boys that saw the creature, that was about a week later after the Lover's Lane incident.
Yeah, that was about a week later after the Lover's Lane.
Well, did they report to the same police department?
It was all local. It was all to the Murfreesboro police.
Right. And the boys had the police then made it very public about the two kids, the two young people, or were they trying to keep that a little secret? I mean, the boys have heard about...
It was reported in the local newspapers.
Oh, it was in the paper. Oh, well, I'd say
they got wind of it, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So really took the kids' word, though. They didn't think that they were just trying to build on the other story?
Well, that's an interesting thought. That kind of stuff does happen. But they took the kids at their words because I guess they found tracks in that area also.
Okay. Yeah,
tracks weren't... too unusual. The tracks were supposedly, you know, maybe 12, 13 inches long, not out of human range.
Right.
But the creature's report, the report of the creature was 7 to 8 foot range.
Now,
and that's something I always look at, you know, how big is the creature?
Right. But that's something that I don't know. I mean, I'm quite good at estimating a lot of different kinds of measurements. People's heights, not so much. And standing away from something that I know, I don't know. So I think that I usually take people's words for height with a little bit of thought. And unless it's somebody who has practice at this, somebody
right.
who's a trained observer, but just if my neighbor or somebody down the block says, oh, somebody, you know, came through here and it was 7.5 feet, I mean, I'm not going to, necessarily bank on that. So so I'm always sort of skeptical, like, okay, who observed?
Unless you have a reference object you
yes.
can go back to.
Mm-hmm. Right, and
like,
if they're standing by a tree.
Some Bigfoot reports, they
yeah.
will say, well, he was standing, he was right by that tree, and his head went to the top of the fork of the tree. Well, you
right.
can go back and measure that.
Yes.
And know that it was a 9-foot creature.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the... But just like if the kid said it was like 7 feet or something, it's like, well, if they didn't have anything to go by, I'm not going to get too excited over that. Like you said, though, the footprint was maybe 12, 13 inches, which is not unknown with men.
No. And unless, you know, I do know the Big Muddy River is a mud bottom river.
Yeah.
Not something you really want to be wading in if you're like a fisherman.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And
yeah.
it's not the kind of river you really would, you not even put your waders on, because you would get stuck in the mud if you tried wading through that. And that was the implication is the creature was using the river to travel and
right.
come up, you know, out of the brush. I do know from being down in the area that the undergrowth around that river is very thick. And it's what I call it, it's what's known as being a squatchy area. You
right.
just look at it and you think, this place is wild. This place could hide anything.
Well, you say lots of underbrush and all. So they make nests? Is this the idea?
Yes.
Of a nest is what, okay.
Well, chimpanzees make nests every night.
A different one.
A different nest every night.
Okay.
They will break their boughs or break tree boughs and pile them up and make a little nest in the tree. So, and gorillas do a very similar thing.
So it seems like if these creatures do a different one every night, even if they're not traveling, I mean, if they're not traveling, would they maybe reuse?
They could. You know, that brings me up to something I've read about. There's a Bigfoot-type creature in Ohio known as the Grass Man.
The grass
that makes these. The grass man makes these elaborate grass nests.
Oh.
And they have found large grass structures made by the Ohio grass man, which is a Ohio Bigfoot.
Well, and those you said elaborate. So are those? Do they think
they're
that
large? They're quite
they're large. And that would be something that might be reused, or I'm just thinking if they make
that's
a new.
That's the implication.
For Ohio, that he probably reuses it if he stays in the same
right.
neighborhood. Yeah.
Right.
But now Big Muddy, if down there like in the Shawnee National Forest and all, he could make a different one every night, but wouldn't sooner or later, I mean, have people just found something that looks like the nest? I mean, several places around and said, okay, this is the nest of some creature. Because if he's doing it every night, there's got to be, depending on how elaborate it is, there would have to be telltale signs.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that squatches do is these tree breaks where you'll find a tree that's broken off really high up in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's broken off really high up in the air with no other trees around it, you know, no apparent reason why this thing might be broken off. And sometimes they do it to mark their trails, mark their territories. Sometimes they break off trees in circles.
Oh, really? They cast a
Sometimes they break trees and move them and stack them in unusual manners that are not natural.
Oh.
They'll stack trees in very unusual manners. And sometimes they're balanced very unusually. That's, you know, that something had to actually pick it up and move this large tree that might weigh 300 or 400 pounds and stack it on top of another one so that it's in a very unusual manner.
Right. Well, now, would those...
But those aren't really nests. Those are more like the signs you could find in the forest if you're looking for unusual things. Those are things to look for.
Oh, okay, but they're not
nests. Squatches in the area.
So what purpose do you think those would
have? I'm thinking more territorial markers.
Okay.
Like if a squatch is traveling out of his normal area and sees that there's other squatches, you know, they know that there's other Sasquatch in the area.
Right, so
there are humans that recognize these signs, and they can tell, okay, well, these signs, the squatches say it's cool for us to walk this way because all the trees will be bent in one direction.
Ah.
And, you know, stay on this area, but if you get off the path, you might find that their trees broke right where you should be walking, and they're saying, pretty much they're saying, no, we don't want you to come this way.
Mm. Well, if that were the case, I think I would heed the signs.
Yeah.
You know, if they're saying, don't come here.
Right.
I could go with that. Just because we really don't know. What about that? I mean, have people been, I think a few people might have been attacked, but has anybody been killed by one? That we're aware of.
In the story that was in Teddy Roosevelt's book, The American Hunter, I believe was the name of the book, he tells a story of some trappers. Then one of the trappers got back, and his partner was killed.
Okay.
In the wilderness.
Right.
But, you know, that's a story that was in a book, and we don't know where Teddy Roosevelt's sources were on that story. Right. Is that a campfire tale that was being told around that Teddy Roosevelt heard one time? You know.
And we don't know, hey, did that trapper kill his partner?
Did the trapper kill his partner and make up a story about creatures?
Exactly. You know? that's something to think on. But back to Big Muddy then. Now,
okay. All right. Now, there was the report by the carnival workers. That was around the 4th of July weekend.
Ah, okay.
And that's why the carnival was in town. They were doing a 4th of July celebration. So over a two-week period is when those reports came in. Now, Big Muddy had resurfaced in 1983 in the same area. Riverside Park area along the river. Yeah. about 10 years later.
And how did he make himself know?
There was just a report of people seeing, hearing the screams and seeing the creature down by the river. That was pretty much the later reports.
And now the screams, were these like screams of pain, or were they a real communication kind of between more than one, or was it just like one saying, hey, this is my territory?
I'm thinking they were probably more territorial.
Okay.
They're saying, here we are. Is anybody else in the area? Any other squatches in the area? We're approaching the time of the year when male squatches in the fall will go out almost every night and just scream territorially.
You mean right now we are. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's just starting to be the good time of the fall is one of the big hot times of the year when people see Sasquatch.
Oh, okay. Well, so then since they're establishing territory in the fall, is this then when they may like mate? And do we know, do they hibernate?
I don't think they hibernate.
No. Okay.
Because here's why I say that. They have been seen in very cold weather.
Okay.
In places like Alaska.
In
the wintertime. I think they're built for cold weather. There has been some reports of some people even think that possibly they have the ability to change their fur color like snowshoe rabbits.
Oh.
You know, in the springtime they'll be brown. Later on in the year they'll start getting white on them, and later on, and then in the wintertime they'll be all white. Their fur will just turn all white, so they blend in with the surroundings.
Okay, but now that wouldn't necessarily be all of them, because like this Big Muddy was summertime around the 4th and white with dirt.
Several reasons. It was either an albino, black pigment. I don't think so. Or it was elderly, like silverback gorillas.
Right.
Or it was just a white one.
Okay. So it could be any of those. I mean, elderly.
Because like with black bears, did you know there are white black bears?
No. I didn't.
There are white black bears. They are so blonde. They are almost white. And they're restricted to an island in British Columbia that has a lot of these white black bears. But black bears go from white to reddish to black to brown. Black bears really come in all different colors.
That's funny. I mean,
yeah,
so
it's funny.
So black bears are a different whatever from your other bears, but yet black is our designation, and it doesn't fit all of them.
It's the name of the breed is the black bear.
Right.
But then in Alaska, you've got what they refer to as a brown bear, which is really the Kodiak bear, which is a little different than the grizzly bear.
Okay. So we have white black bears. So, yes, yeah, so Sasquatch, Big Muddy, whoever could be any color, and for several reasons.
Right.
I mean, like you said, maybe it's just albino, that one. But,
it could have been, but I think there's only been one albino gorilla in modern history that I've heard of.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, that would be.
Yeah. His name was Soflake. He died in about 10 or 15 years ago, and I believe he was in the Barcelona Zoo. I could be entirely wrong about those facts.
But then also you're saying that maybe elderly, maybe they change.
Like silverback gorillas.
Yeah. Or just like any, I mean, a lot of our animals we're familiar with, a lot of dogs and cats will start to get gray.
Dogs will get gray muzzles.
Yes.
When they're older,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but these that we're seeing were, are you thinking that that two-week period in there with the Lover's Lane and the boys and the carnival, that might have just been the same one, or do you think there were several?
I think that was the same one.
Same one. Okay. It didn't seem like it had, it wasn't like limping, or it wasn't an elderly from the looks of it, so.
No.
Being white, yeah. It's interesting, the color thing.
I think it just had white fur.
After the carnival workers saw him eyeballing the ponies, what happened? Did he start toward him, or?
He took off.
Okay. Because he saw he noticed he was seen.
He saw people coming towards him, or he was raising a commotion, and they headed back to the river and took off up the river.
Yeah, okay.
And I believe the cops who investigated the first report heard something coming wading through the water.
Oh. Yeah, because I can't imagine them being that quiet. I mean, I'm picturing this big creature clomping through the mud, making real noise.
Right.
So the cops just heard him, but they were content to hear him and not go trying to chase after where they heard the noise.
Right. And to this day, Murfreesboro celebrates the fact that they're the home of Big Muddy. And in Riverside Park every year for the past 5 years, they have what's called the Big Muddy Monster Brew Contest, where local breweries get together and they celebrate Big Muddy, and there's a mascot-like person that wears a white gorilla suit that's covered with mud.
I'm telling you.
It's the American way.
Well, that's what it's going to say. I mean,
it's a reason to get together and drink beer.
Sure. We will do anything to get together and party. It's like, okay, sure. You know, you throw somebody in that suit and, yeah, well, as long as they have plenty to drink, they'll be good. That's funny. So Big Muddy gets celebrated without any real Big Muddy's there to celebrate. But that's okay. I mean,
that's okay.
Yeah we
but
celebrate.
I heard an interview with the police chief, the chief of police at the time, and he said that was it was the oddest thing. These people are coming up and saying, "We are sincere. This is what we saw," and he's since retired.
Yeah,
but this guy is still alive, and he still comments on shows every once in a while. And he just said it was an odd 2 week period.
Yeah,
in
Murfreesboro
history.
Yeah, in 1973.
Uh huh.
I don't know anything about astrology and all that, but I mean, I'm sure that there would be some people who would say, okay, you know, checking back, this and this was happening in the sky, and it was this whatever, you know, making him more, I don't know, friendly or curious or something. But so that's been like 40 years, and they've not had anything like that. Well, like you said, there was some sighting a decade later, around 83. Could have been the same one, maybe not. But
I'm not. That's unclear.
Yeah. And that was just one sighting, right?
Well, there's a really odd video on YouTube that, and just consider the source, YouTube videos, okay?
There's a lot of good stuff there.
They're really notorious for promoting hoaxes. But there's a really odd video on YouTube now that supposedly came from around Carbondale, Illinois, which is not too far from Murfreesboro.
Right.
That shows somebody, you know, they're running through the woods, and they're like, where's he at? And then for a moment, about three or four frames on this video, you see a white creature coming into the light of the camera, and you can see this really creepy-looking head of a white Sasquatch-type creature running through the screen.
Okay. How long ago was this made? Do you know?
I believe that this one was probably only within probably the past 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
I'll have
why
to research
ask,
this more.
Why I ask is that the little videos and clips from a long time ago, I'm more apt to believe, like, pretty much instantly than something now, because now so many people have their cameras and they fix things. It's so much easier to
right.
do.
I totally understand that.
You know, now than in the past. Wow, Rick, our time is pretty much up. Thanks so much. Info about Big Muddy. And
okay.
We will see you next week.
All right.
Maybe your own story or something like that next week.
Yeah, I'll talk about my personal personal Bigfoot encounter in
Missouri. Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye. So, yes. Next week we have Rick's personal story. And also, next week, my guest will be Rashad Allen from Prestige Designs. And we'll be back also. So, we'll see everybody next Wednesday. Good night. Thank you.